Hello, and welcome to Silver Threads, a weekly program of information on how you can make your senior years shine. I'm Kathy Van Skoyt. Last December, I offered a program called The Caregiver's Dilemma from Scientific American Mind magazine, which focused on how to care for a loved one without losing yourself. Today, I'll continue with the topic of caregiving with a review of the SHARE program and Anatomy of an Intervention, both outlining programs to assist caregivers and care recipients from that article. In addition, I'll offer the poignant story of author Louise Penny, caregiver for her husband in The Last Promise from AARP Magazine, October-November 2016, and Jenny McPhee's story of her experience with her mother's dementia in Refreshing a Mother's Memory with Love and Stories, published in the New York Times, January 2017. And while Jenny is not her mother's live-in caregiver, all relatives of someone with dementia are part of a caregiving team. I will begin with Louise Penny's article, The Last Promise. Mystery writer Louise Penny becomes a caregiver and prays that when her husband's death comes, she is holding his hand. The doctor did not bother with niceties or try to cushion the blow. My husband had dementia, and it seemed to be moving quickly. By then, of course, we knew. I think many families are in the same situation. The medical diagnosis just confirms what we live and see every day. I looked at Michael, his dear face, his clear blue eyes, this man who, as a pediatric hematologist, had held the hands of dreadfully ill and dying children, nodded. I took his hand and held it as the doctor went through the options. It didn't take long. There were none. On the drive home, I promised that he would never be left behind or left out. If I went somewhere, he would go too. It was the first of a number of promises that would be broken. We'll never leave the home we love. I would never speak to him as though he were a child. I would never get angry. I think the first year might have been the most difficult, as big pieces of him fell away, as the blank looks grew longer, as the silences stretched out. Every morning I would write up a series of tests, which I called games, because that was less painful. Math, mostly, and conversions of currencies, and some memory tests, showing him objects, then taking them away and asking him to remember. Of course, at least half the time, I couldn't remember them. He was very patient, perhaps even amused. My day was prescribed by how well Michael did on those tests. If he did well, I was relieved and happy. If he did badly, I was anxious and stressed. I remember my impatience, my annoyance verging on anger, when one day he couldn't figure out how to do long division. The day before, he had done it fine. And now? He was a scientist, a full professor of medicine, a doctor with an international reputation, and now he couldn't divide 2 into 20, and then he couldn't copy a triangle, or write a full sentence, or tie his shoes. We sold our lovely home because he was having trouble walking, and the stairs were not only difficult, they were a danger. I say we, but the decision was mine. I didn't ask him, didn't consult him, for fear he'd say no. It was one of the things I had promised Michael, that we would stay there, and I tried, but we just couldn't. So we moved to a condo, all on one level, underground parking, elevator. It was astonishingly sheer bliss. Suddenly everything had been a struggle was easier, and all the loneliness that came from isolation in that glorious rambling house in the countryside went away. We were in a village, with neighbors, with friends who dropped by, with caregivers right there. And I learned that far from having my day, my happiness, decided by how Michael was doing, I needed to make it about how I was doing, how well I was accepting, adjusting, and looking ahead, seeing issues before they arose. I'd been desperately trying to keep our lives normal, but there was a new normal, and it changed every day. If I didn't change with it, that was my fault, not Michael's. And I needed to understand that, as frustrating as it is sometimes, Michael was not doing any of this on purpose. None of it was his choice. I was the only one with a choice. I asked for help. I brought in caregivers, set up massages 3 times a week for Michael, and yoga classes with friends once a week in our condo for me. We threw a housewarming party, a Christmas party, a party for Michael's 82nd birthday, packed with people, all of whom knelt down to talk with Michael, who smiled the whole time. Michael can no longer walk. He is in a wheelchair and needs a lift to get out of bed. He needs to be cleaned and dressed and fed. But he remains what he always was, the happiest man in any room. And I have found no small measure of happiness, too, and gratitude, that I'm younger than he is and have the strength and energy to care for him, that we have such great friends, that I work from home, that we have the resources to look after him. I'm grateful that his dementia did not make him angry or abusive. I am grateful that I love him so much. Looking after someone with dementia whom you don't like would be hell, and I'm grateful that I'm losing him this way, slowly. We get to live our lives fully, right to the end. Of course, our idea of fully has evolved, too. Our lives are full of kindness, of friendship, of love. There is a clarity now and simplicity. He rarely speaks and no longer knows my name. I think he smiles more broadly when he sees me, but it's possible that my well of wishful thinking hasn't quite run dry. I now set the alarm for 5 a.m. and write until 10. The rest of the day is his. Caregivers come in every day, and that gives me a break to see friends, to read or watch TV, to go for walks or nap, or eat gummy bears in the garden. Every morning and every evening when we're alone, I whisper in Michael's ear that he is magnificent, he is brave, he is handsome and brilliant and kind, that I am so happy to be his wife. I tell him that he is safe and he is loved, and he smiles. Michael is not in pain. He is not anxious or afraid. I am sometimes, but he is not. I cry a lot. I miss him so much. The companionship, the ease, the thoughtful conversations. I miss someone to travel with and have dinners with, someone to discuss the day with. I miss the deep hugs. I miss being loved. I am often lonely and exhausted and feel not quite adequate. I want it to be over, and I dread the day that it is. Sometimes I can't recall what Michael was like before. I can look at photos of him and smile, but the sight of his handwriting reduces me to tears. Most of the time, though, I am content, at peace. Finally, the war relinquished. A friend put it so beautifully, Michael is simply losing altitude. I have promised myself that when he touches down, he will be at home, here with me, holding his hand. Please, dear Lord, let that be one last promise I can keep. Editor's note, Michael Whitehead died peacefully at his home on September 18th. His wife, Louise Penny, was able to fulfill her last promise. And now going to the New York Times, January 2017, Refreshing a Mother's Memory with Love and Stories by Jenny McPhee. My mother is slowly losing her mind. This fact, as well as all of the tragic repercussions along the way, takes up a large chunk of my chats with my 4 sisters and with many of my friends who are going through similar issues with their parents. Recently, my mother's geriatric specialist told me there was a significant rise in dementia in those 60 or older. My mother is 81, particularly among women, and no one really knows why. I later joked to one of my sisters that with women having to endure so much injustice throughout their lives, it was perhaps a relief to forget it all. But that's just me being cynical. This story is not cynical. I have a large family, and at Thanksgiving, we were 35 sitting around several tables in my mother's dining room, and that didn't include us all. My mother once flourished in a crowd, playing the perfect hostess, making every guest feel as if his or her presence was crucial. Nowadays, Any gathering beyond her five daughters flusters her, and she often retreats to her bedroom. During the Thanksgiving celebration, she pulled me aside and said with panic, "Jenny, who are all these people and what are they doing in my house? I feel so strange to be here with all these people I don't know." I reassured her that I felt the same way. In truth, I was relieved that she had remembered my name and knew she was in her own house. I live in dread of a day when she won't. We returned to the party, and I, like a politician's aide, did what I have become good at, giving her subtle reminders of whom she is talking to, where she is, what day, month, and year it is, etc. I also indulge in impatient snaps at her, relying on the high probability that she won't remember them. My mother, for her part, is brilliant at faking it. After a lifetime of faking it in all sorts of ways as a mode of resilience, she is still an expert, compensating for her memory loss with skill and grace. The fact that my 85-year-old father and his 92-year-old brother, their minds razor sharp, were at the Thanksgiving table surrounded by their present wives and their former wives spoke volumes to the expertise women have developed in accommodating men and, indeed, patriarchy. Early on, my mother was a traditional stay-at-home mom, sewing her daughter's clothes and overseeing all things domestic, though she harbored a secret desire to be a writer. Like so many women of her generation, instead of pursuing her dream, she married it. Through my father, who was working at a shipping company then, his literary ambitions were paramount, though, and he went on eventually to become a professional writer. After my parents separated in 1969, I was seven, my mother began to build a robust business as a portrait and wedding photographer. She recently told me that although she would have never chosen to get divorced, she was ultimately glad because otherwise she might never have been forced to discover what she was capable of. Following her divorce, she became active in the local chapter of the National Organization for Women, was a co-founder of a writers' collective dedicated to analyzing gender roles in children's media, and was a co-publisher of two seminal books on sex stereotyping in children's books and primetime TV, Dick and Jane as Victims and Channeling Children. During my childhood, she was the breadwinner, the working mom, her second husband, a stay-at-home dad, who brought five children of his own to the menage. At the time, the domestic arrangement was so unusual that People magazine ran a feature on our family. With my stepfather, she had a fifth daughter, Joan, 11 years my junior. When we were growing up, our mother radiated ambition, possibility, and strength. But above all, she radiated love for us, ultimately pushing us out into the world to shine on our own. And now, my four sisters and I are terrified of a time when our mother won't recognize us. And as with the inevitability of the killer's arrival in a horror film, we know the day is coming. 3 days after Thanksgiving, it arrived for my sister Joan. My mother had gone with Joan to have dinner with her and her in-laws in Brooklyn. They were sitting next to each other at the table, surrounded by others, when my mother turned to Joan and said, "So remind me, how did we meet?" Taken aback, Joan replied, "Mom, you gave birth to me." "Well then," she said hesitantly, "why didn't I raise you?" "You did, Mom." Overwhelmed, Joan excused herself, saying, "Let me get you some water." Perhaps Joan hoped Mom's lapse was because of too much wine and not enough water. Often we sisters console ourselves with the thought about our mother that when the circumstances are right, no alcohol, adequate hydration, a lot of sleep, familiar setting, she does well, her memory nearly intact. During the Thanksgiving holiday, Joan reasoned, Mom had become overtired from having too much family all at once and for too many days. Joan rose from the table and went to the kitchen, crying. Mom followed. Joan, not wanting Mom to see how upset she was, moved to a bedroom, but Mom followed. "Don't cry, please," Mom urged her when they were alone. "Are you crying because you think I don't love you?" "No," Joan said, "I know you love me." "Are you crying for me?" Mom asked. Joan said nothing. Mom took Joan's hand and held it tightly. "This is me getting old," she said. "It is neither easy nor pleasant, but if I can get through this, so can you. Please know that I love you and brace yourself because this is who I am now." Joan sobbed, her hand still in our mother's. "It's not that I don't love you," Mom said. "I love you absolutely. It's just that you have slipped from my mind. These things happen, and this thing will happen again and again. But I love you. I love you so much." Joan's tears were by now a torrent. She felt awful for making our mother worry, for making her feel ashamed of her failing mind. "I know you love me, Mom," she said. "Honey," our mother said, "I don't know your name right now, but you must trust that I will always know exactly who you are. So do this for me. Tell me everything. I want to know every last detail. Where were you born? Where you went to high school and college? What you do for a living? If you are married, do you have children? Come back to the table and sit down next to me and tell me all of it." Since Joan told me this story, her devastation is also mine, but because it did not happen to me directly, my looming question is like a survivor's. Why Joan? Why not me? My sisters and I are so close that I draw great strength from them on an almost daily basis. This gift of unity I attribute to my mother. So why Joan? There are rational explanations, like the fact that Joan lives in Los Angeles, or that, in memory terms, she was the last one in and therefore the first to go, but none of those work for me. Mom has always had a special love for Joan, not greater, just different. Perhaps that is because she is the youngest, unique in her combination of parents, and as such, a sense only an only child, though she has 9 siblings. Perhaps it's because she was, and is, a bridge between the 2 families, or because as a child she was very serious and always a tad sickly, or because Joan's father, her primary caretaker, died while she was still in college. My mom has been profoundly protective of all of us, but a little more so of Joan. That Mom managed to muster a magical, mystical self for Joan in that very difficult moment for both of them, that she could speak above and beyond and in spite of memory, that she was able to dig deep and find her brightness, I attribute to her particular love for Joan. That evening in Brooklyn, Joan did as Mom asked and recounted her life story. Our mother could have forgotten any of us, and one day she surely will, but her meta-lucidity, amid terrible confusion, driven by powerful love, has given us a way forward. She has affirmed for us the extraordinary power of a mother's love, as if that love were a force, like gravity, governing who we are and how we behave as human beings during our orbit on Earth. Jenny McPhee is a novelist and a translator. Her new translation of A Family Lexicon by Natalia Ginsburg will be published in April. And now we're going to that Scientific American Mind article and a section called Anatomy of an Intervention. Among the most successful approaches to helping caregivers is the New York University Caregiver Intervention, or NYUCI, designed to support people tending to loved ones with dementia. The program was based on work in the late 1990s by NYU psychiatric epidemiologist Mary S. Middleman. A key measure of its efficacy is the fact that caregivers in the program are able to successfully tend to their loved ones at home far longer than non-participants, delaying the need for institutionalization. Positive results from NYUCI have now been found in interventions in 5 states. University of Minnesota gerontologist Joseph Gogler and his colleagues have adapted NYUCI for adult children caring for parents. In 2013, they reported that just 37% of adult child caregivers who participated placed their parent in a facility versus 66% in the control group. Caregivers also reported better quality of life, reduced depressive symptoms, and less stress in response to disruptive behaviors. NYUCI is a multi-pronged program that includes referrals to support groups and mindfulness programs. The chief component is a series of individual and family therapy sessions targeted at problematic psychological dynamics within the caregiver and among family members. In addition to regularly scheduled sessions, participants can reach out for ad hoc counseling by telephone whenever they need it, whether dad with dementia is screaming through the hallways at night or the caregiver's brother is accusing his beset sister of trying to put mom away. Across cultures, family dissension has long been shown to increase caregiver strain. A classic 1993 study found that for married caregivers, daughters, siblings were both sources of support and stress. And a 2014 study of 90 dementia caregivers in Colombia found that negative family dynamics were significantly associated with caregiver depression and stress. Cheryl Fairbanks, 65, of Roseville, Minnesota, participated in Gogler's intervention in 2009. "I was caring 24/7 for four parents, her own and her husband's, in three houses with an assortment of ailments, including my mother's vascular dementia," she recalls. Fairbanks had recently left a long career as a successful IT executive. Her sister, she says briefly, was not available for caregiving or to attend family therapy sessions. Fairbanks' husband was her primary helper. As part of the program, Fairbanks met for 90 minutes a month with family therapist Mark Reese, either at her home or at a nearby coffee shop. Reese helped her through diverse practical and emotional struggles over a period of 18 months. "Mark saved my life," she says, of the experience that ended on May 2012 when the last parent died. Reese rescued her from depression, she says, by helping her see the big picture and find meaning and pride in her situation. The success of this program has led, this past July, to the creation of NYU's Alzheimer's Disease and Related Dementia Family Support Program, based in New York City. The state-funded program offers free counseling to caregivers in the area, either in person, by video conferencing, or by telephone, depending on the caregiver's preference. Middleman is currently recruiting caregivers from across the country to participate in a study to determine if the video conferencing version can match the results of the original in-person program. If the remote intervention succeeds, it could reach many more people in need of support. And now a review of the Support Health Activities, Resources, and Education, or SHARE program, based at the Benjamin Rose Institute on Aging in Cleveland. It offers some insight into how empowering planning ahead can be. Over the course of SHARE, counselors offer people with early stage dementia and their caregivers 5 to 6 sessions in which the care partners learn about how the disease progresses, what decisions will need to be made at each point, and what support family, friends, or professionals might provide. Working together, the counselor and care partners develop a practical, written plan that the caregiver can refer to when the person with dementia can no longer adequately express preferences. This plan is a potent tool to relieve caregivers' feelings of guilt or inadequacy when they need additional help. Preliminary findings of controlled trials of SHARE, according to its principal investigator, Carol Whitlatch, are that after counseling, caregivers take advantage of more services to help them cope. They also have a greater understanding of and better communication with their relative compared with members of a control group who received a single information session. Although SHARE was designed for dementia caregivers, Whitlash says she has recently been awarded funding by the Retirement Research Foundation to adapt the program for other chronic conditions such as cardiovascular disease and diabetes. An example, Nancy and Jim Scott of Fairfax County, Virginia, participated in SHARE in 2015. The couple, she is a former teacher and he a retired public housing expert, have been married for 40 years and raised two daughters together. Today, Jim, 78, is stricken with Alzheimer's, and Nancy, 69, has recently decided to make use of respite services, taking Jim to a center where he can socialize with other dementia patients. The choice was not easy. I'm so afraid of hurting my husband's pride, she says, when he looks around and sees the other people who are there. Jim has led a life of the mind, and now he's losing that. She might not have been able to take this step had she and Jim not attended SHARE, at which point Jim insisted that he did not want to burden his loved ones. He wanted Nancy to accept help. As his condition progresses, the Scots will face more challenges, but by banding together as a family, making informed decisions, supporting each other, and seeking help as needed, they can better weather what lies ahead. Making a plan for Jim has also helped Nancy to envision her own future. She recently became a grandmother and is setting aside time to enjoy her granddaughter, Meredith. She also hopes to become involved in Alzheimer's advocacy. I try to think about my life and how I'll do it, she says. I want to come out the other end still vibrant and healthy. Given the new science from which she has benefited and the choices she has made thus far, her odds look good. Well, I think the takeaway for me from that information is how important it is to realize you need help and be willing to ask for it and receive it. Two websites that offer comprehensive information on help venues are ALZ.org, or the Alzheimer's and Dementia Caregiving Center, which has a 24/7 helpline, and HelpGuide.org. Thanks for listening, and until next week, I'm Kathy Van Skoik. You've been listening to Silver Threads, a production of WXXI Reach Out Radio in Rochester, New York. The audio producer for this show is Maureen Rich, and I'm Kathy Van Skoik. I hope you will join me again next week for more information and updates for making the best of your silver years. If you'd like to hear this program again, you can download a podcast of the show at our website, wxxi.org.